Lecture 30, The Partition of 1947.
The creation of any new nation requires deep transformations, not just political and logistic, but also in the hearts and minds of its new citizens. In August 1947, the British Empire withdrew its rule from over South Asia and partitioned its colony into two nations, India in the center and Pakistan with one wing in the west and the other 1,000 miles away in the east. This British withdrawal was far too late for many people and abruptly too soon for others. While many people in South Asia had long been demanding that the British quit India, the births in 1947 of the separate nations of India and Pakistan were nonetheless sudden and traumatic. None of the principal parties, British, Indian, or Pakistani, was really ready for what would take place. The borders were uncertain in critical places until after these new nations had been born. Indeed, some of their vital boundaries, especially Kashmir, remain violently disputed even today, nearly 70 years later. So, cruelly hot mid-August 1947 became a time of celebration of national independence for many newly free Pakistani and Indian citizens. But it also proved a traumatic period for many millions of refugees who were suddenly left enemy aliens in a hostile place that had been their family's home for centuries. We've already discussed in previous lectures the longer process of the development of competing nationalisms in South Asia, as various leaders and communities envisioned their new nation in different and disputed ways. World War II brought these conflicted visions to a climax. Throughout the war, the British government had as its highest goal its own perilous survival in the face of fascist Axis powers. As soon as Britain declared war on Hitler's Germany in 1939, the Viceroy of India declared India at war with Germany too. Then, in December 1941, he declared India at war against Japan. Before these declarations of war, the Viceroy did not even consult Indian leaders, let alone the people of colonial India. Had he done so, he would have found some anti-Nazi sympathy among those Indian leaders who were anti-fascist. But many more progressive Indian leaders were also anti-imperialist and pro-nationalists, so the Viceroy did not even ask. Further, many Indians regarded the Japanese as fellow Asians who were also fighting against European imperialism and winning dramatic victories over the American and British forces in the Pacific. As we've seen, about 40,000 Indian soldiers of the British Indian Army who had been captured by the Japanese then joined the Indian National Army to liberate their nation by force. Throughout the war, the British demanded great sacrifices from India, but provided little in return other than vague promises for the post-war future. Some 2.5 million Indian soldiers served the British Empire, comprising about 20% of all its armed forces. Many of them returned with military training and an awareness that they were as martial as Europeans and not racially inferior. The British government of India loaned some 100 million pounds sterling to the British imperial government, money that Indians had to provide. Plus, the British war effort demanded vast amounts of clothing, equipment, and food from India, taken with little concern for the effects on the Indian economy or people. As a horrific example, the 1943 famine in Bengal became another tragic proof that British policies prioritized its wartime goals over the lives of Indians. As the Imperial Japanese Army began to invade the frontiers of India along its border with Burma, the British government confiscated grain and boats in its path. This was nearly a scorched earth policy in a densely populated countryside. The grain mostly went to Bengal's cities to keep urban Indians quiescent and to feed British and American troops. The lands of eastern Bengal are, as you know, very productive rice-producing areas and are also dependent on riverine transportation. So their grain and boats were taken away, causing many millions of people to begin to starve, Of these, about 3 million people died, mostly in rural areas. And millions more dragged themselves to the cities to try to find any food at all. This man-made, or rather British-made, famine convinced many Indians that the colonial government had no regard for their lives. Further, throughout most of World War II, the British imprisoned many of the Indian National Congress high command, including Jawaharlal Nehru and Mohandas Gandhi. That greatly contributed to a weakening of the Congress's control over popular anti-British sentiment. This therefore cleared the way for its rivals on the left and on the right, and for parties based in Hindu or Muslim religious communalism. On the left, the Communist Party of India lost credibility during the war when it was directed by Stalin first to support Hitler and then to support Russia's British allies. However, other leftists worked hard to liberate their Indian nation. Especially in August 1942, there were widespread and often violent uprisings in many regions. Many in these popular movements freed themselves from the culture of submission to the colonial state and by destroying its symbols of authority. In Bihar alone, for example, 170 police stations, post offices, and other government buildings were destroyed. But there were large numbers of British troops stationed in India, which was the main staging base for the war in the Pacific. The British colonial government used these troops to crush many such popular movements. On the right, the war proved an opportunity for the hundreds of Indian princes to prove their loyalty to the British with manpower and financial and political support. Recall that over the century of East India Company conquest, from 1757 to 1857, one-third of India remained under British indirect rule. The roughly 600 surviving Indian princes were guaranteed the security of their dynasties as long as they supported the British Empire. Since 1921, the Chamber of Princes had coordinated their voices and influences within the empire. These Indian aristocrats had strong allies in the British Parliament, especially in its House of Lords. The British promised to respect the hereditary rights of these Indian princes as long as they suppressed any political movements within their own states. Hindu nationalists also expanded their support during the war. Their use of religious symbols like the Mother Goddess mobilized large numbers of Hindu supporters into political action. But in the process, they alienated many Muslims. The Hindu Mahasabha political party started in 1909. The membership in this party overlapped with the right wing of the Indian National Congress. The more forceful Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh was founded in 1925 as a well-disciplined national service organization composed of men who had dedicated their lives to working full-time for the advancement of the Hindu nation. The RSS, self-proclaimed Hindutva or Hindu-ness movement, would continue with intermittent success up to the present, as we'll see in future lectures. Most significantly, the Muslim League, under the sole command of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, was able to advance its own agenda during the war. The British government needed their support and was willing to make concessions in order to obtain it. Jinnah himself held the title sole spokesman for the Muslim League, and he proved an astute and articulate leader. The abstract idea of a Muslim nation had been developing for decades. The name Pakistan had been invented by a Cambridge University student, Chowdhury Rahmat Ali, in 1933. The name both means land of purity and is also an acronym for the provinces he optimistically expected would comprise Pakistan: Punjab, Afghania, Kashmir, Sindh, and Balochistan. Note there's no B for Bengal in the name. Until the 1940s, the Muslim League for the first time began to resolve to create a separate dominion for Muslims. They did so with the British support. In his presidential address to the Muslim League that year, Jinnah shifted his rhetorical strategy radically to characterize Muslims as a separate nation from the Hindus. He declaimed, quote, Notwithstanding 1,000 years of close contact, nationalities, which are as divergent today as ever, cannot at any time be expected to transform themselves into one nation merely by means of subjecting them to a democratic constitution and holding them forcefully together by unnatural and artificial methods of British parliamentary statute. Muslims are a nation according to any definition of a nation, and they must have their homelands, their territory, their state. He continued by saying, quote, Islam and Hinduism are not religions in the strict sense of the word, but are in fact different and distinct social orders, and it is a false dream that the Hindus and Muslims can ever evolve a common nationality. Close quote. As a nation, Muslims deserve their own nation state, Pakistan. Through astute appeals to Muslim voters that Islam was in danger, Jinnah was proved able to mobilize them as never before. He eventually convinced most Muslim voters that they would betray their religion if they voted for any candidate not committed to Pakistan and the Muslim League Party. Only a small minority of Muslims supported the Indian National Congress and the idea of an undivided India. Meanwhile, British efforts to hold India during the war and thereafter faltered. In April 1942, the British Unity War Cabinet under Conservative Prime Minister Winston Churchill sent a Liberal politician, Sir Stafford Cripps of the Labour Party, to India with a set of weak concessions designed to obtain Indian wartime support with a minimum of actual cost to the Empire. These concessions including a proposed willingness by Britain to discuss Indian constituent assemblies and the possibility of Pakistan, but only after the war had been won. Churchill himself undercut such supposed concessions by declaring that he had not become the King's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. For their part, the often imprisoned Indian National Congress leadership felt betrayed by such flaccid offers. Gandhi spoke for many of them, calling this a post-dated check on a failing bank. So the Cripps mission produced even more frustration on all sides. In June 1945, the British sought to retain control of balancing equal numbers of Hindu and Muslim members in an Indian Executive Council to head an interim government. But Jinnah demanded that he alone select all the Muslims appointed. This meant that any Muslim leader who supported the Indian National Congress would be excluded, regardless of his popular support or other personal qualifications. Jinnah accused those few Muslim leaders in the Indian National Congress of being just token showboys. So Jinnah's demand frustrated that proposal. But for popular support among the diverse Muslims of South Asia, Jinnah had to design and manage a complex set of often contradictory programs. For one, he had to gain the cooperation of traditional Muslim religious leaders, many of whom objected to Jinnah's personal lifestyle. Conversely, he evidently felt contempt for their backward-looking values and their resentment against him. Yet he nonetheless made symbolic gestures in his dress and behavior in order to convince them to accept his leadership for the greater good of the community. They mobilized their followers using the appeal that Islam was in danger. Simultaneously, Jinnah had to hold on to the support of the landed class that provided the economic basis for the Muslim League. These landlords had great power over their many tenants. So Jinnah had to threaten to retire again unless they accepted his continued leadership, even as he was making popular appeals against what he termed exploitative capitalists and landlords. Jinnah could not afford to be very precise about what the nation of Pakistan would be, or even where it would be located. He needed the votes of as many Muslims as possible, so he deliberately used only an abstract concept of Pakistan. Any specific details about its actual boundaries and the territories it would leave out would only disappoint some of his supporters. But as long as he kept his appeals to the Muslim community inspiring but general, he was able to garner their broad support. In his negotiations with the British and with rival INC and other political leaders, however, Jinnah had to be more specific. His most comprehensive demand was that all of the provinces that had Muslim majorities had to go entirely to Pakistan. In particular, this meant all of the large provinces of the Punjab and Bengal. But large minorities in those provinces were Hindu or Sikh. Jinnah therefore had to convince his negotiating opponents that despite his fiery rhetoric, the substantial non-Muslim populations in those provinces would be fully protected citizens. So, would his Pakistan be an Islamic state, or a state for the protection of Muslims as a social community, or a secular state with both Muslim and non-Muslims as full citizens? Jinnah made each of those arguments at one point or another in his career. Countering Jinnah, the INC and the British argued that only districts, that is counties, with a Muslim majority, and also that were contiguous in the western or eastern regions, would go to Pakistan. That meant the partitioning of the major provinces of the Punjab and Bengal, since there were Muslim majorities in only about half of those regions. Jinnah dismissed this as a, quote, moth-eaten Pakistan. But that is what finally came to pass. Some revisionist scholars, most notably Aisha Jalal, have argued that Jinnah did not really want a separate Pakistan at all. Rather, his demand for a separate nation was only a bargaining ploy in order to obtain greater powers for himself within an undivided India. Indeed, Gandhi once offered Jinnah leadership of the entire undivided India if he would agree to it. But Nehru and the other Congress leaders refused to accept this. As the Allied war against Germany and Japan ended in costly victory in 1945, the end of British colonial rule over India became ever more evident. The powerful promise by Franklin Roosevelt, echoed by Harry Truman, that the war was for national self-determination, put pressure on the British government to withdraw from its crown jewel of empire. Britain had been exhausted of blood and treasure, making imperial rule in India impossible to sustain. The British election in July 1945 that replaced Churchill with a Labour government under Clement Attlee showed popular sentiment for concentrating on British domestic recovery. All but the most die-hard British imperialists became at least temporarily reconciled to the end of the British Raj. The divide among Indian voters between the Indian National Congress and the Muslim League also hardened. In the elections of 1945-46, the Congress won 90% of the open seats for the central government and also established the Congress ministries in 8 of the 11 provinces of British India. For its part, the Muslim League won all the seats reserved for Muslims in the central legislature and 80% of those reserved for Muslims in provincial legislatures. Overall, it secured 75% of all Muslim votes. But the nature and extent of the new nations that were about to be born remained disputed. Early in 1946, the British cabinet sent a mission with a plan for 3 loosely federated collections of provinces based on their religious majority, with only a weak central government. The hundreds of Indian princes would be free to join their states to either India or Pakistan, or to remain independent. At first, Nehru seemed to accept this plan, although it gave all of the Punjab and Bengal to the Western and Eastern collections, respectively. While Jinnah disliked many aspects of this plan, it did meet his demand that the Muslim majority provinces not be divided. But then, in a July 1946 speech, Nehru asserted that everything could be reorganized once the British left. This enabled Jinnah to claim betrayal and to repudiate the plan as well. As negotiations for independence proceeded, Jinnah drove hard bargains. To prove his popular support, in August 1946, he declared a day of direct action. While he did not explicitly call for violence, it broke out in several areas. Muslim, Hindu, and Sikh mobs, including many demobilized but battle-hardened soldiers, clashed. More than 10,000 people were killed over the following week, with many more wounded and burned out of their homes. This was a grim foretelling of the mass violence of partition just a year later. In 1946 as well, scattered groups of Indian seamen and soldiers rejected the authority of their British commanders. So the British lost the trust they had held in the loyalty of the Indian Armed Forces. Finally, in February 1947, the British appointed Lord Louis Mountbatten as the last viceroy to oversee the transfer of power. He was the great-grandson of Queen Victoria and a cousin of the current British king, George VI. Mountbatten immediately moved the projected date of independence ahead by nearly a year to August 1947, just 5 months after his arrival. This meant that the official preparations had to be greatly rushed. The government, army, and the entire administration, including the treasury, had to be divided in a hurry. Further, Mountbatten pressed Jinnah and Nehru to accept that the two independent nations would be partitioned out of colonial India, with Bengal and Punjab divided along religious lines. Since the official boundary commission contained both Muslim League and Congress members who could not agree, its chairman, Sir Cyril Radcliffe, made the impossible decisions about where the boundaries would be, that is, about whose homes would be assigned to the nation that would accept them as citizens or reject them as aliens. The commission did not even announce its allocation until days after Pakistan and India were already independent nations. But desperate fighting had already been going on for months. The result was what would today be called ethnic cleansing, leaving the western wing of Pakistan 97% Muslim, with about 5 million Hindus and Sikhs driven out. The madness and trauma of the partition for millions remains almost inconceivable even today, especially for the many survivors on all sides of the still disputed borders. For instance, a man who made himself among the world's greatest short story writers, Saadat Hasan Manto, struggled to convey to his contemporaries the all-too-real, inexplicable experiences of partition using the unreality of fiction. Manto personally embodied some of the deep conflicts inherent in the partition. His Muslim family had generations earlier migrated from Kashmir to resettle in more prosperous Punjab. But Manto himself never fit into the society around him. He never succeeded in school or in his early career as a journalist. During one formative period, he struggled to survive by doing translations into his native language, Urdu, of short stories by Victor Hugo, Oscar Wilde, Anton Chekhov, and Maxim Gorky. The kind of deep thought and analysis necessary for artistic and yet faithful translation provided him with insights into the nature of short fiction. During his 20s and 30s, Manto gained recognition as a screenwriter in the burgeoning Bollywood movie industry. But his income from this occasionally lucrative work was spent reveling among Bombay's underclass of petty criminals, sex workers, and drunkards. As the earthquake of partition continued to demolish the structure of Indian society, growing hostilities among some Hindu Indians against all Muslims pressured Manto out of the film industry. Reluctantly, he emigrated to Pakistan, but he never fit in there either. He lived off the erratic income from his fiction. As it happened in India, the new Pakistani government put him on trial for obscenity in some of his stories. Popular as his writing was, it challenged almost every cultural value and even the very basis of the Pakistani nation. He continued to drink heavily, often the very cheapest and most abundant liquor. For a time, his family put him in a lunatic asylum to dry him out, but he soon relapsed. In addition to the mastery of the genre, much of the power of Manto's short stories comes from how he poured his agonies of identity into his fiction. Perhaps his most famous short story, and one that is particularly relevant here, is entitled Toba Tek Singh. The central figure is a Sikh landholder who has long been locked up in a lunatic asylum located in what is now Pakistan. As the emotions around the partition rise and peak, the inmates each try to comprehend what suddenly being an Indian or a Pakistani means. they began to divide into increasingly hostile factions based on what they confusingly remember about their past lives. Eventually, the new governments of India and Pakistan decide to relocate the inmates based on their officially recorded religion and also the location of their family homes. But the inmates themselves often have no clue about which side of the newly created border their homes lie on, whether they will be returning to their homeland or deported from it. Since Sikhs and Hindus are to be expelled from Pakistan, the inmate known as Toba Tek Singh is finally driven out from Pakistan, but he refuses to enter India. The story ends with him collapsing, either catatonic or dead, in the no man's land between. Manto himself died at age 43, defiant and also alienated until his end. Subsequently, many powerful Indian and Pakistani fiction writers have attempted to convey even a small part of what the events of 1947 mean. Excellent works include Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children and Amitav Ghosh's The Shadow Lines. The trauma of partition was not only remembered in fiction. Some of my old personal friends have had their earliest childhood memory being forced to flee their homes at partition as their relatives died around them. One Sikh friend, every time he smells kerosene, is jolted by it. As a very young child, his family was surrounded by a murderous mob. His father doused their entire family in kerosene, deciding to kill them all rather than die horribly at the hands of the mob. Just as the father was about to light the match, a passing military unit drove off the attackers and escorted the family the remaining dozen miles to safety in India. But they arrived with nothing but what they could carry, and it would be decades before the family could rebuild a life in India. Another friend, a Muslim from a family long settled in Delhi, managed to reach safety in the ruins of an ancient fortress. His aunt died during childbirth as they huddled among the other refugees with no food or water for days. Finally, they were able to return to their looted and burned home, knowing that some of their neighbors had taken part in the destruction. Even years after partition, the now independent governments of India and Pakistan searched out in each other's lands for the 40 to 50,000 women and children who had been abducted and forcibly made part of the family of their abductors. Some had partially reconciled themselves to their new lives, but they were given no choice. Once identified, they were forced to move to their official nation, Muslims to Pakistan, Hindus and Sikhs to India. Often they had no family left there or were spurned by their relatives and somehow contaminated by what they had gone through. Official policies of repatriation of such women only ended in 1954. Even the general number of refugees and deaths is disputed, but most likely figures are 10 to 12 million refugees and 1 to 2 million deaths. In any case, it was one of the largest tragedies and forced migrations in human history. Only now are people in India and Pakistan coming to terms with what their parents suffered and committed during the partition. Also, about as many Muslims stayed in India as lived in West or East Pakistan. While India is officially secular, there are leading politicians and political parties who question the place of Muslims in today's India. Gandhi became one of the last victims of partition on January 30, 1948. He was assassinated by Natram Vinayak Godse, a pro-Hindu nationalist who believed passionately that Gandhi was favoring Muslims and Pakistan, fasting until India gave its share of the pre-partition treasury legally due to Pakistan. Gandhi's sudden death shocked the new nation of India. It discredited the Hindu right for a time, but it also meant that Gandhi's ideal vision of a village-based economy and a non-violent government would never be implemented. In the next lectures, we'll look at the recent histories of the new nations of Pakistan and India that did emerge from the partition.